From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a thing on.
Donald Trump has chosen a critic of carbon regulation to lead the EPA and a fast food CEO to run the Labor Department. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate. And our special guest is Henry Olson, senior fellow at the Conservative Ethics and Public Policy Center. Welcome, everybody. Andy Pudzer is the CEO of CKE Restaurants, a company that owns two fast food brands you might be familiar with, Hardee's and Carl's Jr. But he won't have that job for long, because Donald Trump intends to nominate him to run the Department of Labor. I think this marks the start of what's going to be one of the major internal tensions within Trump's economic vision. That is, Trump is promising more decent middle-class jobs for workers, but he's also promising companies a lower-cost, more competitive employment environment. So are American workers paid too little, or are they paid too much? Pudzer's past commentary on the labor market is what you might expect from a fast food CEO. He's been critical of minimum wage increases, of the Affordable Care Act and the mandates it imposes on employers, of a pending rule that would force employers to pay overtime to more of their workers, basically things that make it more expensive for companies to employ people because they have to pay their workers more. In a divergence from Trump, he's also been supportive of comprehensive immigration reform and has noted the difficulty companies have finding workers without immigration. The Pudzer vision seems like the sort of thing that might make companies more inclined to employ people in the United States, but that might not create the sort of secure middle-class jobs that Trump made a show of saving in Indiana last week. So, where is this going to land? Are American workers going to feel enriched, or are they going to feel betrayed? Henry, what do you think?
I think it shows that there's a tension in the GOP coalition. It's not just within Donald Trump. It's the question of how much of the new voters that Donald Trump brought in, people who want protection, people who want active government to raise wages and lower competition, how that sits with traditional GOP. I think that what's going to have to happen is the GOP is going to have to give, and that some of these things that Pudzer thinks he wants to do right now are going to have to take backseat to the sorts of wage-raising, job protection things that Trump promised.
Rich, do you think that's right, that the Trump vision is likely to win out over the sort of more traditional Republican vision?
Well, we have this shotgun marriage between orthodox conservatism and Trump's populist economics. And that tension was there within Trump's economic program during the campaign, because he talked a lot about tax cuts. He talked a lot about deregulation of the sort that Pudzer supports. At the same time, he is a protectionist and an immigration restrictionist. And there are going to be a number of points of tension here. Medicare reform will be one. The protectionism will be one. And immigration will be another. And Pudzer kind of represents that orthodox conservatism plus an orthodox view of the pro-business right on immigration. And I kind of doubt that Trump is going to completely backtrack on his views on immigration, but there have been a couple signals here. One is this appointment. The other is going with General Kelly rather than Chris Kobach for the Department of Homeland Security. Kobach has been someone who's lived and breathed the immigration restriction fight, you know, for a decade or more, and had become a lightning rod because of that. And to me, the Kelly pick sort of signaled they just didn't want to spend the political capital on a Kobach confirmation fight. So there's at least some signs of some softening here.
Dahlia, what do you see as the role for the left to play here? Because as this intramural fight plays out on the right, I assume liberals will generally come down on the side that the government should promote higher wages, higher paying jobs. But the Trump program toward higher wages is very different from what liberals would ordinarily prescribe. They would not put immigration enforcement at the center of that. Most of them wouldn't put trade restrictions at the center of that. So where should the left put itself as this fight happens?
Well, I think they're going to continue to push hard for minimum wage and be dubious of buzzed her for that reason. But I do think that Rich is right, that he really has been incredibly moderate on immigration. He called the 2013 immigration bill, you know, the right thing to do. He's been, I think, really in opposition to what Trump has said about immigration reform all along. And so I think progressives can hope that he is sort of a moderating influence on what's been a pretty draconian program. And I think, you know, progressives are going to try to hold him to his pre-cabinet rhetoric that, you know, America is better off for immigrants and their work ethic and the other things he suggested.
The thing that frightens me when I think about where this immigration fight could land internally in the administration is that we could sort of end up with the worst of both worlds. Trump spent most of his time on the campaign trail when he talked about immigration, talking about the wall and these sorts of border enforcement measures. Now, maybe that was just because that was what connects with voters. Voters don't get excited about E-Verify and internal enforcement things that make it hard for employers to break employment laws. But you could see a Trump administration that would build a wall, that would do a bunch of quite punitive things around the border, around sanctuary cities, that sort of thing, but that would not make any real effort to stop employers from employing people in the country without authorization. That would probably be pretty satisfactory to employers that want to be able to break employment law. But that doesn't seem to me like an outcome that would serve either conservatives or liberals well on immigration policy.
Yeah, I think that's right, that would be a temptation. It would be one that he should resist, which is that what people want from immigration restriction is immigration restriction, not a show of it, not an attempt to demonstrate concern about it, but an actual reduction in the number of people who are coming to the United States who are directly competitive with people who are losing their jobs because of international competition. If that's not delivered in some way, then I think you're going to see trouble within the party, but also trouble in the coalition with the people who aren't Republicans, who voted for Trump as the first presidential candidate in the last 30 years that they actually thought had their back.
Within the tension over immigration policy, it's E-Verify where the rubber really hits the road, because this is not a symbolic measure at the border. You know, wall is not going to hurt anyone. You know, some people may hate the symbolic message it sends. Others might love it. But it doesn't make – that's not really – going to make a difference one way or the other on how many immigrants are coming here. It's whether they can get jobs or not. And an E-Verify system that's mandatory and has teeth is going to be a burden on employers. And folks like Pudzner, who in his prior role would not like E-Verify because it's another regulation. So that's really where the kernel of the dispute over immigration, the crux of the matter on immigration policy is going to be.
Yeah, Rich, I think one interesting thing here is going to be, in general, the position of Democrats on E-Verify has been that they're happy to do it as part of a broad, comprehensive immigration reform package. If there is an effort to do it in Congress, and it's controversial among Republicans, some of whom view it as a key immigration enforcement measure, some of whom view it as a costly mandate on businesses that do not want to be forced to have to figure out whether their employees are legally allowed to work in the U.S. Where will Democrats land on an E-Verify law that would not be part of a broader comprehensive package? Are they willing to go for more enforcement that's aimed at tightening the labor market, even if they don't get the parts of immigration reform that they really care about? I also think the overtime rule is interesting here. I understand why Trump has landed where he has on minimum wage and various other things, but the overtime rule, which would lead to many workers who make as much as $47,000 a year being entitled to overtime, seems like a rule that would do a lot to benefit exactly the sort of working class, middle class voters that Trump did relatively well with this time around. I'm wondering why the consensus there seems to be so strong that this is a bad meddlesome intervention with businesses. Isn't this an opportunity for Trump to again buck Republican orthodoxy, do something that's good for the middle class that the business class doesn't like?
One of the things that I think Trump wants to do is create a climate whereby business naturally pays higher wages on their own. And what you're talking about there is kind of like a targeted direct wage increase that is mandated by the government. And that seems to rankle him. Whether or not he can get what he wants, whether he can create that climate where wages are increasing naturally without direct government diktat, is really one of the first questions that we'll have to ask over the first 4 years is whether or not the deregulation plus jawboning plus trade restriction produces the increase in wages that his voters expect.
The metric for Trump, more than GDP growth, will be wage growth, because what he's trying to do is use traditional Republican means to create a generally pro-growth environment. At the same time, he adds his populist element to try to more directly, create a tight labor market through discouraging offshoring and outsourcing, by tightening up on immigration, and by soaking up labor with an infrastructure program. And all that's aimed at creating a reliable increase in wages in a way we haven't seen in a while.
Yeah, and let's not forget fossil fuel exploration and expansion. Is that you take a look at economies that weathered the Great Recession really well, it's countries that exported natural resources to the growing economies in the rest of the world, like Canada and Australia. And those were places where people without college degrees did very, very well, mining or trucking or logging or doing something related to the production and transport of these things. So the nomination of Pruitt to head the EPA and other things relate, and you know, if the nomination of McMorris Rodgers to Interior comes about, this is actually part of a coordinated wage enhancement strategy by freeing up a sector that disproportionately pays high wages to people with low educational attainment.
Sure, but the thing is, Trump doesn't seem to have any problem with directly telling companies what to do. He went to Carrier and told them not to move their production to Mexico. So I'm wondering, as part, you can do these things that might indirectly raise wages, but why not just directly tell companies to pay more if part of your intention is to, if the key intention of your economic policy is to get companies to pay more? And I understand the argument around the minimum wage, that if you have workers who have low skills, who are not, who might just simply not be hired at all if you said that their wage had to be higher, then there's a big trade-off there. But the overtime rule and some other things seem like they are aimed at the middle class workers, where you might actually be able to jawbone companies into paying higher wages. It seems like that would really be Trump delivering on his promise to put jobs first, but would put him directly in conflict with a lot of the business leaders who are hoping for tax cuts and deregulation that will make them more profits. It seems like that's really where the rubber meets the road. That's a question of, is economic growth going to go into wages, or is it going to go into corporate profits? He could put his thumb on the scale there for wages, but it would do a lot to fracture the coalition.
It would fracture the coalition, and that makes all elements less likely to happen. You also, I think he's staking his economic plan on the idea that he can have his cake and eat it too. Now, we've seen many presidents who make a U-turn for 2 years when they see either politically or economically it's not working out. But I think that's where he's going to go for the next couple of years. And that means things like this, the overtime rule, are not going to be pushed until original economic policy is tried and found wanting.
Dahlia, we saw Trump pick a personal fight this week with the leader, not of a national union, but of a union local at that Carrier plant in Indiana, who was critical of the way Trump talked about the deal that he cut there, saying that Trump overstated how many jobs that he saved. What is the role for labor going to be in this? Because obviously, you know, there's going to be a lot for labor to disagree with what Trump does. But then also some of the stuff that he does on trade, for example, might be appealing to certain labor unions. What in this environment should they and their allies on the left be doing to try to advocate the interests of workers?
That's sort of the paradox here, Josh, is that, you know, it would behoove Trump to keep labor on side, or at least to not go out of his way to pick fights. I think if you sort of track the arc of that story, labor was as excited as anyone when he first announced the Carrier deal. And he sort of turned around and went after an individual by name on Twitter and, you know, unloosed the crazy upon him. And so I think you're quite right. I think his interests can be aligned in some instances, for all the ways we're talking about, with labor. And it's fascinating that he chose to pick this fight right now. I guess it goes a little bit to the idea, to sort of the larger idea, that as, you know, organized labor gets more and more and more diminished in this country, it will probably be less relevant or material to President Trump to keep them on side.
I don't think there's anything very strategic about this. Trump just saw the guy on TV criticizing him and was irritated by it and wanted to hit back. And it makes me queasy just because you don't want to have a situation where individual companies or people are nervous about attacking or criticizing the president of the United States for fear that he might attack them back and kind of unleash a bunch of online and real-life hate against them. But it seems as though Trump is very attached to this means of communication, and it's not going to change.
Let us know what you think about Trump's Twitter habits at kcrw.com/LRC. Up ahead, the EPA. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Dahlia Lithwick of Slate. And Henry Olson, a senior fellow at the Conservative Ethics and Public Policy Center, is also with us. So in other transition news, Scott Pruitt, as Henry mentioned before the break, the attorney general of Oklahoma, will be nominated to direct the Environmental Protection Agency. Pruitt has drawn national attention for suing the federal government, including the EPA, trying to block what he would call intrusive regulations, including on carbon emissions. Pruitt does not exactly deny climate change, but he does insist that both the extent of global warming and the degree to which human action drives it is a very live scientific debate. This is one of these picks that I would say is not very Trumpy. Conservatives like it and liberals are outraged for much the same reasons they'd probably feel the way they would about an EPA pick in a different Republican administration taking office this year. So, Dahlia, is this an outrage?
Well, I think it's an outrage insofar as, you know, as this individual pick goes, you know, there was this big investigation by the Times, a 2014 letter that Pruitt sent on state stationery to the EPA that was, drafted by the companies. So I think there is, you know, certainly some there for the liberal outrage. But I guess I just think, Josh, this is of a piece with these appointments that seem to be putting people in cabinet positions where their central mission is to undermine both the rollout of Obama protections that have been created, but I think the protections in general. And so it's not a surprise. I think it's dispiriting that he is as in bed with the lobbyists as he is.
Rich, we had a Supreme Court decision about a decade ago that doesn't just allow the EPA to regulate carbon. It actually obligates the EPA to regulate carbon emissions. So what is the future of an EPA led under somebody like this? Can the Trump administration really try to just do nothing to limit carbon emissions? And if so, won't they just get tied up in court forever?
I think they should try to do basically nothing to fight carbon emissions, and it'll make negligible difference as opposed to the Obama administration if you're really your goal is to try to influence the temperature of the planet 100 years ago. All this is really, in those terms, has been very symbolic, but it has very real-world consequences on the economy. And I think it's more important to focus on the consequences here and now on the economy rather than what we might do to shave, you know, a tenth of a point off of global temperatures 100 years from now, assuming the models and our understanding of this hugely complex phenomenon are correct. So I just think all the liberal alarmism about this administration's the end of the planet is just really completely absurd.
One thing I see when I look at the politics of this right now, and Henry, you alluded to the idea that creating jobs in fossil fuel extraction and things like that is a good boost to the economy now from having a more pro-fossil fuel view. But there's this short-run, long-run trade-off, where if you take the risks of climate change seriously, which I do, then you have big costs that come far down the road that you have to weigh against labor market benefits that might come very soon. And I guess the question is, shouldn't voters think more about those long-run costs? Isn't it a structural problem that people are so focused on the short term, and shouldn't we find a way to get people to think more about that trade-off?
Well, I think people have been trying to get them to think more about that trade-off for many, many years now. And what's quite clear is that climate change is a low priority for all but the most committed progressive voters, and that voters who are interested in and open to voting for a Republican candidate is virtually no priority. And I think some of that has to do with not a scientific uncertainty over the fact of climate change, but a very real scientific uncertainty over the degree of climate change, that below the headline numbers, you always see that there's actually a wide variance of scientific opinion as to whether it's going to be a mild or a catastrophic warming. On the mild side, it makes much more sense to adapt rather than attempt mitigation strategies. On the other side, then clearly it's catastrophic and we need to be moving at all speed ahead. That's an open political question, but not just here, but in other countries, voters that are open to voting for the right just don't have it as a high priority because they haven't really been convinced that that upper edge of climate alarmism or climate change actuality is serious enough that they need to take it into consideration.
Dahlia, do you think it's true that people just don't care about this that much? And if so, what can be done to change their minds?
Well, I think people do care about it, and I don't think it's, you know, just entirely, you know, the deranged hippies on the far left. I think a lot of people care, and I think that the other thing that's important that we haven't talked about is the sort of global and international conversation around this and what it would actually mean if Trump makes good on his promise to, quote, cancel the Paris Accord altogether. I think that there is a sort of not just what, you know, the average American voter thinks conversation to be had around this. But I do think that at least around the issue of climate change, there are very, very serious international repercussions to just sort of turning the switch the way we're talking about doing.
But isn't that just one in a long list of things that President Trump seems to intend to do that would have big international repercussions on international agreements? I mean, this is someone who's talked about NATO as being obsolete. I don't think it moves him or his voters, the idea that leaving the Paris Accord would be disruptive to international relations.
No, I think that's right. I think it's pretty clear that this is one in a long menu of things that alarms us about the way he thinks about international treaties and obligations. But I do think that it matters what the world thinks of us and of Trump. And I think pulling out of the Paris Accord really in a deep, deep way sends a signal that is, you know, of a piece with other signals. You're right, Josh, but also a very, very alarming international signal about where we are as a country.
Rich, when I look at nationalist movements, especially in Europe, that are in many ways similar to the one that Donald Trump has capitalized on, a lot of them are much more environmentalist, actually. Is there something that you think is specific to U.S. politics that makes these issues less salient here than it is in other countries on the right?
I don't know. I hadn't really thought about that. I just think for the type of voters that Trump was appealing to in the places where those voters live, the fossil fuel economy is really important. So this is, we talked earlier in the show about the tensions between kind of traditional conservative economics and Trump's more populist approach. This is something where there's complete accord, where the deregulatory kind of anti-government traditional conservatism goes really hand in glove with Trump's desire to help these workers doing, you know, real physical labor, you know, fracking and drilling and all the rest of it.
It's funny because when Pruitt talks about these issues, one of his key areas of focus is basically that the federal government is overstepping its bounds and should leave more matters to the state. But there seem to me like two key points of tension there. One is that environmental regulation is one of the areas where federal regulation seems to make the most sense because many of the things that are done have regional or, in the case of carbon emissions, global impacts. The other is that Donald Trump does not seem to be concerned at all about keeping the federal government within its bounds and staying out of things that are properly the business of other people. So I guess, you know, moving beyond carbon, should Trump be taking a hands-off approach on the environment in general, or is this another area where there are opportunities for him to break with the Republican consensus on the idea that the federal government should back off?
I think the primary environmental issue that motivates people in the environmental community today is climate change. And there's just really not much of a reason, unless you believe in those upper-end boundaries, to make that a high priority in light of the economic dislocation that a large part of America has felt, in light of what the mandate that he received is. So I doubt that you're going to see Donald Trump try and significantly water down clean water or significantly repeal clean air regulation. But with respect to climate change, it's just not something that his voters are particularly cared about. They have things that they care much, much more about that they perceive as being directly and negatively impacted by an aggressive climate change agenda. And I don't think there's anything that politically he can or should do in order to address that.
It just feels like there are things you could do in other areas like particulate emissions, where you could have a Donald Trump-style industrial policy. Let's build lots of electric cars in the U.S. Let's see clearer air in our cities and less smoggy days. Like it would have these attractive Trumpy deliverables associated with them. It would also, you know, that would please the left because a lot of the things you would do to reduce particulate emissions would also reduce carbon emissions. But it seems like there's room for him to take a page from someone like Marine Le Pen, who has had environmentalism as part of her agenda, and mesh it with a sort of localism that aligns with Trump's America First. Let's look for effects here in the United States. I'm not holding my breath for him to do this. I'm just saying there would be a way for him to do an interesting cross boundary thing there.
I can't prove this, but my guess is from a subjective level, electric cars just don't do it for Donald Trump, and that he considers them, you know, wimpy and kind of new agey. And when he thinks of industry, you know, he thinks of a smokestack, and just environmentalism is just kind of not his thing.
Well, we've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Dahlia Lithwick, what's your rant?
I would just say that we're creeping up on what I like to call outrage fatigue, and that there are so many ethics questions around the lack of transparency with Trump's taxes, with his financial dealings, with slapdash tweets about what he is and isn't going to do in terms of divestment. And it's just really easy, I think, to believe that what was news on Tuesday is gone by Wednesday. And we really, really, I think, need to remain outraged, even though it's a fire hose, drinking from a fire hose. I think it's important to remain outraged about these emoluments clause violations and the ethics violations and the lack of serious divestment.
Henry Olson.
My outrage is the continued seeming desire to relitigate the election that I see perpetrated across virtually every platform of the mainstream media. That, like it or not, he won. It was a historically oddball election. Nothing like this has ever happened before, with losing the popular vote by 2% but winning the Electoral College. If a Trump supporter, I would think that this is great, because the more they complain, the more it seems to legitimate that Trump's got their goat. I think treat him more like a normal president, let on, and deal with things he actually says rather than trying to relitigate the past.
Rich Lowry.
Dutch politician Geert Wilders has been convicted of a hate crime for addressing a rally that chanted in favor of fewer Moroccan immigrants in that country. A European political class that is literally criminalizing the opinion that there should be less immigration is courting a populist backlash, deserves a populist backlash, and is getting a populist backlash.
For my rant, I want to disagree with Dahlia. I think it's literally impossible to maintain outrage for four solid years. And it's sort of unfortunate because there is a lot to be outraged about. And if you made a comprehensive list, you could fill your entire day every day with things to be outraged about. But if people try to be outraged all the time, ultimately they're going to become numb and they're going to look a little bit hysterical to the large number of people out there in the country who didn't vote for Donald Trump but are prepared to give him the benefit of the doubt. I think we need to go through this exercise. We need to watch Donald Trump try to be a good president. And if he fails, then we'll point out that he failed, and voters will listen to us when they see the negative effects from his presidency. Of course, if he succeeds, then we're going to have to deal with that. But I think it's important to go through that motion of letting Donald Trump try to run the country in a positive way before, rather than prejudging him and saying before his presidency has even started that it is a failure. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Dahlia Lithwick, and Henry Olson. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.